From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The fear that children would be seduced into becoming gay reached a fever pitch in the 1970s. That's when former beauty queen and singer Anita Bryant launched the Save Our Children campaign and warned about homosexual recruitment.
If homosexuals are allowed their civil rights, then so would prostitutes or thieves or anyone else.
LGBT rights advocates have fought against this perception for decades, relying on evidence that sexual orientation is something you're born with. But University of Utah law professor Clifford Roski argues it's time for a different approach. Today on the program, we're talking with Roski about what he calls the fear of the queer child. Plus a new website, Mormons and Gays. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The fear that somehow homosexuality is contagious, or that children can be persuaded or seduced into being gay, has been around for a millennia or so, and the concept still is out there. Gay rights advocates have long argued that the data shows it's more nature than nurture when it comes to sexuality. But a University of Utah law professor says that approach needs to be updated. Today on the program, we're talking with Professor Clifford Roski about his take on LGBT rights and what he calls the fear of the queer child. Clifford Roski is an associate professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He previously was a research fellow for the Williams Institute on Sexual Orientation Law and Public Policy at the UCLA School of Law, where he co-authored over 30 demographic reports on lesbian, gay, and bisexual populations in the U.S. He also developed teaching materials on sexual orientation and the law, and he's a member of Equality Utah's Board of Directors. Professor Roski is with me in studio, and Professor, good morning. Thank you so much for your time today.
Good morning. Thank you, Jennifer.
You can see draft copies of his articles, Fear of the Queer Child and No Promo Hetero, Children's Right to be Queer, through links on our website, kcpw.org. We'll have those up and available shortly. Later on in the program, a Mormon conversation about same-sex attraction. But first, nature versus nurture in the gay context. If you've got questions or comments about the LGBT movement and the ways that the law has weighed in on this, you can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Before we begin, Professor Roski, maybe you can define what you're talking about, the fear of the queer child. What is this?
So, Jennifer, this is one of the big ideas of opponents of gay and transgender rights. It's the simple idea that exposing children to homosexuality or gender variance makes children more likely to exhibit those traits themselves.
Okay. So the basic argument is you want to dispel this notion.
Absolutely. And this is something that the LGBT movement has been engaged in for a very long time, because, of course, they're well aware of the fact that opponents, like, as you said in the preview, Anita Bryant, most famously, relies on the threat of homosexual recruitment to indoctrinate children into homosexuality. She says, if we allow, for example, gay teachers to be openly gay in the classroom, they will indoctrinate or proselytize children into homosexuality. And my basic position is that's something that parents and children can work out by themselves, but this is none of the government's business. The government shouldn't be taking sides in whether a child grows up to be straight, gay, transgender, whatever.
There's no state interest in it, you argue. What got you thinking about this, this fear of the queer child and getting rid of this fear and perhaps introducing a new strategy to confront the fear?
So when I entered this field, I began by studying custody and visitation cases involving a gay parent and a heterosexual parent. So these are old cases in which men and women get married and they have children, and then either the mother or the father realizes that they're gay, they get divorced, and they end up in court, over custody and visitation issues. And I looked for themes that came up in those cases. What were the arguments that the heterosexual parent was making about why a gay parent shouldn't have custody or visit their child? And the most popular argument by far was that the parent would either indoctrinate the child deliberately or sort of even unintentionally, serve as a role model to the child and somehow influence the child's sexual or gender development. And then I realized that this wasn't only coming up in custody and visitation cases. Indeed, it comes up in every gay rights argument ever made. That is, it's used to justify laws that discriminate against gay and transgender people in marriage, adoption, public education, and even employment, where Anita Bryant again said that we shouldn't protect gay people from employment discrimination because that would mean we would have to hire openly gay teachers who would influence children.
Hmm. Before we go further, can you tell us why you decide to use the term queer instead of LGBT or LGBTQ, as we're often told, or gay, just simply gay?
Absolutely. Well, there are a couple of reasons. It's to some extent, it's a term of art in the scholarship. But in this context, I simply wanted to point out that it's not just limited to influencing children's sexual development, that is, turning children homosexual. It's also more broadly about influencing children's gender development, that is, whether or not they conform to traditional gender stereotypes, that is, will boys be masculine or girls be feminine? In fact, most of the examples of this fear, particularly far in history and also in recent times, are more concerned with boys being masculine and girls being feminine, and less overtly about whether children are gay or lesbian.
We will get to Anita Bryant later in the conversation, but this idea, this fear, goes way back. You know that it goes back to the time of Aristotle. It's been with us for hundreds of years.
Yes, and I was quite surprised to find that, because 150 years ago, there was actually no word for homosexuality in the English language. The concept didn't even exist yet. It was developed by psychologists in the late 1800s. Back then, people talked about sodomy, not homosexuality. And sodomy was a really vague concept that included heterosexual acts as well as homosexual acts. In its most broadest sense, it included all sexual acts that were not procreative, that is, everything that was not male-female intercourse. But even then, I found that people expressed what I call the fear of the queer child. They worried in particular that male teachers would sodomize boys and then turn the boys into what they called sodomites. And that just meant people who engaged in sodomy. And as you suggest, I even found a version of this in one of Aristotle's most famous texts, which was published more than 2,000 years ago.
Hmm. So this is a fear that is deeply rooted. We're speaking with Clifford Roskey, an associate professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He's also a member of Equality Utah's Board of Directors, and he's the author of a couple of draft articles on what he's calling the fear of the queer child. You can see links to those shortly on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, we're talking about this fear of the queer child and strategies, new ways of thinking about combating or furthering gay rights, I suppose I should say. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Gay rights made huge strides in the 1960s. I'm thinking of the Stonewall Riots in 1969. But then in the 70s came Anita Bryant, the singer. She really gained some notoriety when she launched this Save Our Children campaign. Can you remind listeners who maybe weren't around then what exactly this Save Our Children campaign was?
So Anita Bryant, I think, made her name as a Miss America contestant and then as a sort of singer of Christian songs. And in Dade County, Florida, the county passed an ordinance, much like Salt Lake City's ordinance, which protected gay and transgender people from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. And Anita Bryant's reaction was to launch the Save Our Children campaign. And she was quite explicit that what children needed to be saved from in Dade County was the threat of homosexual recruitment. She said, and this is a quote, "Homosexuals are recruiting our children. They can't reproduce, so they must recruit in order to sort of sustain themselves." And she focused, you know, an employment discrimination law protects firefighters, stockbrokers, everyone from discrimination in all kinds of employment. But she focused very specifically on openly gay teachers, and said that she sort of passed around a pamphlet that she said gay teachers were handing out at the local high school. And she sort of made this debate about whether gay teachers could recruit kids. And she won in a landslide election. I think she won about 66% of the vote. The ordinance was overturned. And that was really a turning point. She gained national attention for that campaign. And it became a model for the religious right in opposition to the new gay rights movement that was replicated across the country in a wide variety of campaigns very successfully for many years.
It certainly sparked a lot of protests at the time and sort of polarized the issue for a lot of people. This indoctrination idea, tell us more about how that has filtered to today. I mean, we're talking from the 70s to 2012. I mean, how is that indoctrination idea still alive and well?
It is. But what Anita Bryant did was actually quite sophisticated. So for, as we said, hundreds of years, even thousands of years, this fear was expressed in a very particular way. It was expressed as the fear of seduction or sexual abuse. That is, particularly that men would sexually abuse boys and turn them homosexual or something like that. And what Anita Bryant did was take the sex out of it. She certainly included that fear of sexual abuse, but she also sort of refined it, sanitized it a bit, and would talk about not only recruiting and proselytizing, but the idea that a teacher would just serve as a role model, which is a much more plausible and less sinister version. She would say that children could identify with a gay teacher and imitate the teacher.
They look up to this person.
Exactly. And it's much less demonizing of the teacher, and it's giving the child the active role. Or even, she said, that if we allow teachers to be openly gay in the classroom, that could serve as a kind of public approval of homosexuality. It would send a symbolic message to children telling them it's okay to be gay or transgender. And so there, it's not the child, it's not the teacher, it's even the government itself that's just sort of sending the message. And we see this all over the place in current debates. I think most prominently in the Proposition 8 campaign in California. This was a constitutional amendment in California to ban same-sex couples from marrying. And in one of the commercials, a little girl comes home to her mother in the kitchen. It's sort of a classic domestic scene. And she says, "Mommy, guess what I learned in school today?" And the mom says, "What, honey?" And she says, "I learned that a prince can marry a prince, and I can marry a princess." And the mother's face just sort of falls in horror. And then actually a law professor appears, one of the rare commercials where that happens, and says, "Think it can happen? It's already happened." And he talks about a case in Massachusetts in which something like this occurred.
So Anita Bryant, that idea, alive and well.
Absolutely. And in opposition, so there's a law before Congress, I think for 38 years now, there's been a law proposed to prohibit discrimination against gay people in employment, and now it includes transgender people. And just a couple of years ago, the Traditional Values Coalition, an organization that represents about 30,000 churches and actually includes members of Anita Bryant's original campaign, they launched the law is known as ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and they launched a campaign called ENDA Hurts Kids, and it said, "Do you want a man in a dress teaching your children?" And it talks about how transsexual teachers will be indoctrinating kids if this law is passed.
We're talking about the fear of the queer child and also dispelling that fear with Clifford Roski. He is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law, also a member of Equality Utah's Board of Directors. And if you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got questions or comments about the fear of the queer child, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking with University of Utah Law Professor Clifford Roski. He's a longtime advocate for gay rights, but he says LGBT advocates may need to change their tack a little bit when it comes to dispelling what he calls the fear of the queer child. He is an associate professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law and a member of Equality Utah's Board of Directors. He's also got a couple of articles out that will be published next year, Fear of the Queer Child and No Promo Hetero, Children's Right to be Queer. And we'll have links to those on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, what do you think about Roski's ideas? What arguments do you think work in the LGBT rights debate? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Before the break, Professor Roski, we talked a little bit about Anita Bryant, the significance of what she did in sort of galvanizing an anti-gay movement. How did the LGBT movement respond to those arguments? What were some of the ideas that they were putting forward saying, hey, this isn't right. Think about this issue this way.
So again, the central claim of Anita Bryant's campaign was that if you expose children to homosexuality or gender variance, you make them more likely to be homosexual or gender variant. And the LGBT movement traditionally has responded to this claim by saying it's false. It's just factually incorrect. It's a myth, a lie, a misunderstanding.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it turns out to be a little tricky. If you say sort of, obviously a gay teacher can't sort of wave a magic wand and turn a kid gay. Homosexuality, we now all know, is not a contagious disease. But if you think of the more plausible versions of the claim, for example, if a child has same-sex desire and has an openly gay teacher, well, the kid may well be more likely to come out of the closet. And the real problem here is that one side says good and the other side says no, bad. Mm. And so the whole premise of saying, oh, this is false, it's not true, is that it would be bad for a child to be gay or transgender. And so what I want to do is sort of shift the premises a little bit and just say, you know, this is none of the government's business, whether a child becomes gay or transgender. This is something that should be worked out between parents and children, and the government shouldn't be taking sides in children's sexual or gender development. And that we can't justify policies that discriminate against gay and lesbian people as an effort to promote heterosexuality or gender conformity in children or in anyone else.
Hmm. What about the LGBT activist reliance on science? I mean, there has been a lot of research about how one becomes or discovers or realizes, whatever verb you want to use, that he or she is LGBT. I mean, why not rely on the science to clear all this up?
Well, and I think more than anything else, I think my argument could supplement the science instead of replacing it, right? Because there are a couple of moments. Again, the claim is so broad and so flexible, this fear, that it applies just to behavior and not to desire. For example, even if a child considers herself to be lesbian, opponents of homosexuality are likely to say, well, we don't want her to act on that desire. And so there is actually a little bit of evidence that girls in particular who are raised by lesbian mothers are a little more likely to engage in same-sex behavior or identify as bisexual instead of heterosexual. And so once you start coming up against the sort of limits of the science, then I think it's useful to sort of shift the debate and say, you know what? Let's question the premise that the government has a business in managing children's sexual and gender development, because I think that's actually very questionable as a matter of constitutional law.
So you're not saying that the science doesn't matter?
Oh, I think the science matters a great deal. I think the thing you can take away from the science is that this fear is largely incorrect, that even, for example, 85% of girls raised by lesbian mothers are completely heterosexual in every single way. Now, it might be that that percentage is a little bit higher with girls raised by heterosexual mothers. The difference is really minor. It's not the kind of difference where you say, if you have a gay parent, well, then you're going to become gay or anything like that.
Hmm. Speaking with Clifford Roski, an associate professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, and we're talking about something he calls the fear of the queer child and dispelling that fear. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. And let's go to the phones. Miriam's joining us from Salt Lake City. Miriam, hi. Oh, it looks like we lost Miriam. She had a comment about saying that the majority of people, when people are different, the majority of people fear them. I'm not quite sure how that's going to figure into our conversation. Miriam, feel free to call back. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. What about modern psychiatry? The DSM used to label being gay as a disorder. I think that's been reversed, but the American Psychiatric Association still has a diagnosis called gender identity disorder of childhood.
Although, actually, that's being revised.
That's being revised. Okay.
Well. So, yeah, until the early 1970s, the American Psychiatric Association considered homosexuality to be a mental illness, as you suggested, and gay people were treated for homosexuality in search of a cure. And some of these treatments were quite harsh. They included chemical castration, electroshock therapy, aversion treatment. And those treatments now are widely understood to be unsuccessful and harmful. They cause depression and suicide more than anything else.
Mm.
And as you said, even now, right at the moment, the diagnostic manual of the American Psychiatric Association refers to gender identity disorder, but that is now being revised as gender dysphoria, the general idea being you could have a psychological sense of yourself as male or female that's not aligned with your body. And so you can sort of be treated to help make the transition from one gender to another if that's something that you desire. And there's also the problem of intersex children who are born with different sort of sex markers, for example, ambiguous genitalia or chromosomes, and they were traditionally subject to quite invasive surgeries to kind of make them male or female. But all of this is very much in flux in the medical establishment.
Mm. Again, 801-355-TALK if you'd like to join our conversation with University of Utah Law Professor Clifford Roski. Looks like Miriam is back with us. Miriam, hi.
Hi, sorry about that. Let me preface this by saying my mother is a Holocaust survivor. So I grew up understanding anti-Semitism and things like that. That in this day, in this time, that people, and globally, still discriminate, shut out, even kill others who are different. It is a sin. And in America, you know, we're supposed to be this great nation that these things still happen. It is just bad and wrong. I am not gay. I am a supporter of gay rights. I believe that if a religious institution chooses not to recognize or marry gay couples, they have that right. But we are long past the time where this should even be an issue. You know, who cares? You are what you are. I am what I am. And let's just get past it.
Miriam,
you can't fight fear and belief with logic.
Miriam, thank you so much for the call. It sounds, Professor Roski, like Miriam is right in line with your thinking that the government really doesn't have a role in determining whether or not you are gay.
And she's really made a very interesting connection. So the idea that a particular minority is preying on the children of the majority and sort of turning them or recruiting them is not actually limited to gay people at all. The myth of blood libel in the medieval period in particular, how Christians believed that Jews would kidnap children and use them, sacrifice them in Jewish ceremonies. As a Jew myself, I'm familiar with the myth. And also, around the same time that the concept of homosexuality emerged, there was a very common myth that black men were preying on white girls, you know, sexually. And so it's a very common technique for the majority to demonize a minority by talking about them preying on children. And of course, anxiety about children is pervasive and, you know, deeply influential. We all worry about the fate of our children. They represent our future and sort of the innocence in our society. And so perhaps one of the last bastions of prejudice is feelings about children and what will become of them if they're exposed to, you know, sort of less traditional influences.
Miriam, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to Mary in Murray. Mary, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because my son is actually, I think the new DSM calls it gender dysphoria. He's almost six, and I've known this about him since he was probably 2 or 3 years old. And I considered myself to be pretty well educated and a feminist, and I thought that I had, you know, any biases brought to light. And it was interesting as a parent to realize that we kind of raise our children to be straight by default in a heterosexual family. And it brought a lot up for my husband and I. We're very supportive of our son, and we ended up switching churches because we didn't want any of our children to feel like who they were or who a group of individuals were wrong because of something that was said, done, or the subtext of a model. And so now we go to an open and affirming church, and now my son is in kindergarten, and working with the schools, and it's really interesting the responses that I get from some of the teachers or staff of, oh, they grow out of that, or anything like this, and yet my son is starting to be picked on in school. And I find that sometimes this is because of parents that have these biases that then gets passed on to the child, and other times it's just because of the culture. And it was brought to light by a neighbor who had come over and let me know that her sons were having trouble with my son's gender identity. And she was incredibly compassionate and wanted me to know that this was not the view of her or her husband, and you know that to please feel free to speak with her sons if they ever said anything or did anything while they were over playing. And so I guess how does this apply with the way, because it's beginning to interfere with my son's education. And I know, I mean, they don't give you a manual of how you approach this with the school systems. And the social worker at the school has been fantastic. And we've read the Hipponotopus, which is about a hippopotamus that wants to try out all these other different kinds of animals. And that idea of this, you know, this is no different than you liking green or anything like this at this age. But is there anything that as a parent I can have in terms of knowledge to empower myself whenever I go in and advocate for my child and his education and how his gender identity seems to be affecting his education? And it's not his gender identity, it's people's reaction to his gender identity.
Sure. Mary, thank you so much for the call. Let's get Professor Roski's take on this. Professor, this almost seems like the flip side of what we've been talking about. We've been talking about teachers indoctrinating children. Well, here's a child who has a gender identity issue, and so how does the world really react to that child? And again, what is the state's interest in protecting the rights of that child? And I guess addressing Mary's question, go ahead.
First of all, Mary, thank you for sharing that story. It's a really powerful story, and I appreciate your call. Just first of all, to answer your question directly in terms of what can you do, I think it could be, if you haven't already, to reach out to Equality Utah and to the Utah Pride Center. I think that they can provide very helpful materials and sources and individuals who could help you navigate your interactions with the school. One important question is whether the school district in Murray, in which your child goes to school, has adopted a non-discrimination policy yet. Many schools, now I think we're up to about 10 schools, districts in Utah have adopted policies of non-discrimination in sexual orientation and gender identity, which can be very helpful in terms of educating the educators about these issues. And it's certainly, I think your story really exemplifies that there is a gap with respect to homosexuality and gender identity. The diagnosis is only now being revised in terms of gender identity. That happened many years ago now, 40 years ago now, with homosexuality, and that reflects a gap in public opinion. People are beginning to understand that some kids are gay or lesbian or bisexual, but people are much slower to adapt to the idea of a transgender child. And you see all the themes, Mary, as you suggested, coming up. Oh, this child isn't transgender. This child is confused. They're going through a phase. They said the exact same things about gay kids even 10, 20 years ago. And it's a real struggle. There are signs of progress on this front as well. The New York Times Magazine just a few months ago ran a cover story, "What's So Bad About a Boy in a Dress?" And I couldn't tell from Mary's call whether this is a child who was born as a boy and identifies as female or vice versa. But if that's the case, if it's someone born male who identifies as female, this is easily the touchiest subject. This is what Aristotle was worried about thousands of years ago. So it can be a real uphill battle. And it just takes what Mary exhibited during her call, which is sort of inner strength and perseverance and the kind of integrity that she showed in terms of her church and standing up with educators and to educators and calling on all sources of support. So I do think that the Pride Center and Equality Utah could be particularly helpful in working through these issues.
Mm. Mary, thanks for the call. Professor Roski, our time is running short, but at the end of the day, if I understand you correctly, the law needs to be not only colorblind, but sexually oriented blind, if that makes any sense. There's no state interest in whether a person is gay or straight. But do you think that there is a state interest in ensuring protections for people who are different?
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So I think a nice analogy here is how we think of the law and religion, right? That the state does not have an interest in promoting any particular religious belief one way or another. And in a similar way, the state doesn't have an interest in promoting one sexual orientation or one gender identity or another. But of course, there are limits to what parents can do to influence their children. Certainly, to take obvious cases, it's child abuse if you deny a child food, clothing, shelter, or beat a child. So certainly, if a parent has a gay or transgender child and they do any of those things, that's child abuse, and it would be treated as such under any state's laws and under federal law. Now, there are obviously little things that parents do. My mother said, why don't you find a nice Jewish girl and settle down? I happen to be heterosexual, so the girl part didn't bother me. But that is, there are banal little things that parents say to children, often unintentionally. You don't know what a child's sexual orientation or gender identity is going to be. As Mary said, as she was a feminist and she didn't realize all of the different ways that we raise our children to be straight, both in sexual and gender terms. But there is a line that can be crossed, and that children have to be protected from parents who cross that line. And it's been quite common in Utah for particularly transgender children to end up homeless because their parents kick them out of the house.
Hmm. So adding to the arsenal for the LGBT activist, you say the state doesn't have an interest, but they should be including some sort of normative challenges to this idea that a queer child is immoral or inferior. What do you mean by normative?
That is, normative just means should, right? So the conversation has always been, well, can the state make a child straight? And I want to say, well, let's put that aside, the question of whether the state can do this. That's a factual question. I want to ask the question, should the state be in the government, that is, should the government be in the business of trying to raise children one way or the other? And I really don't think they should. I think that's inconsistent with our American tradition that the family is the place where children are raised.
Clifford Roski, he's an associate professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, also a member of Equality Utah's Board of Directors, and he's written a couple of articles on this topic, Fear of the Queer Child and No Promo Hetero, Children's Right to Be Queer. And we'll put those up on our website, kcpw.org. Professor Roski, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Coming up next, a new online tool from the LDS Church about gays. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Since the LDS Church's outspoken support of California's Prop 8 in 2008, Mormons have been targeted to explain their doctrinal approach to homosexuality. Well, last week, the church unveiled a new website to do just that. And today on the program, we're getting reaction to the church's statement on LGBT issues. Joining me in studio is Valerie Larrabee. She's executive director of the Utah Pride Center. Valerie, good to have you. Thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
Also with us by phone, State Senator-elect Jim DeBacchus. He will be representing District 2 in the Utah Senate, and he'll be the only openly gay legislator on the Hill. He's also the leader of the Utah Democratic Party, and he's joining us by phone from the halls of Congress, I believe, in Washington, D.C. Senator-elect, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here. I am in Washington. I don't know if it's the halls of Congress.
You can join our conversation. What do you think about the new Mormons and Gays website? How do you think the new tool will affect LGBT individuals within and without the church, outside of the church? You can call us 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Senator-elect, I'll start with you. What do you think? Were you surprised by this online resource?
I was very pleased with the website. I know there are a number of people in the LGBT community nationally and locally that don't think it goes far enough and that are having some difficulty with some of the language. But when you consider what the atmosphere was right after Prop 8 and where it is now, I think this is a much better place for our community, that there is this kind of communication and understanding and even respect, and that this is certainly a step forward, especially for LGBT, LDS, young people all over the world and their parents, who oftentimes felt as if they had to decide in a Sophie's choice between their children and their church. I'm not sure that ever was their real choice, but a lot of parents perceived that. This makes it clear what parents' responsibility and families' responsibilities are. I think that's a very positive step.
Valerie Larrabee, a division among the LGBTQ community about this website. Why?
Well, I think as Jim pointed out, there has been a lot of pain that has been felt, and not just since 2008, but, you know, for many people in our community for a lifetime, about the feelings of the church toward who they are in the world. And so I think that, you know, the broad acceptance by community organizations and by Jim and his leadership in our community, what we're all pointing to is that the real greatest gift of this website allows parents to better understand the position of the church with regard to a parent and child's relationship on this issue. Never before has there been a resource that's been put out by the church that could be seen not only in the U.S., and also the real stories that are told on the website, but also this website will be viewable in many other countries. And I'm sure that in those countries, this conversation is even more difficult than it is here. So in that way, we feel that there's a great change here. To reiterate, I think the largest challenge with our community, particularly here in Utah, is, you know, we're at the heart of this conversation because we're located in the city where the world headquarters is. And so those hurts and you know, there's a lot of dislike of Mormon doctrine. And we recognize wholly that, you know, we can't change the doctrine. Some people wish that we could. And the best we can do right now is advocate for those within the church that are given more time to work with their parents and loved ones about this issue before they get kicked out or ostracized or isolated from the family.
Speaking with Valerie Larrabee, Executive Director of the Utah Pride Center, also with us, State Senator-elect Jim DeBacchus, and we're talking about a new Mormon website, an online tool addressed to Mormons and gays. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. The website has some video clips of LDS apostles. They're very high leaders in the Mormon Church, urging compassion for those with same-sex attraction. I want to play a short clip. This is Elder Todd Christofferson in a statement of why the church is putting out this website.
We're not endeavoring here to try to cover the waterfront and address every issue that could be and needs to be addressed in different settings relating to same-sex attraction. But the idea is to open us to all of us to greater understanding. And you'll hear stories and experiences from quite a diversity of people and backgrounds and perceptions. They're genuine, they're real, they're authentic. And while you see some saying this didn't work and this did in a progression in life, we feel that this can only lead to greater sensitivity and better understanding, and that's what we're about.
State Senator DeBacchus, I mean, what do you make of a statement like that coming from one of the church's highest officials?
Well, remember, I go back a long way. I mean, I went to BYU under the Wilkinson administration, where they said, where they used to send police up to the bars in Salt Lake and take down license plates and then call people in and say, all right, give us the names or else. I mean, from that to where we are today, I don't think doctrinally there has been a change, but I think the attitude and the feeling of the church leaders that I have met with are profoundly decent. And I think that evolution on how to deal with this whole thing has changed. I don't think there's any question about that. And I give a great deal of applause. Now, is this gay marriage? No, it's not gay marriage. And do people, proponents of gay marriage, of whom I am one, do they have a reason to be disappointed? Yes. Is this website the know-all, end-all? Absolutely not. But it is for LDS people, and that's the intended audience. It is for that family struggling in Heber or in St. George or in Smithfield. This is a genuine step that allows people to have a much better situation with their own families and in their own wards, and it's hard to argue against that.
Valerie, you noted that this is not a doctrinal change. I mean, so you understand the disappointment from some in the community who say it really doesn't go far enough.
I do understand. I'm one of those that believes that. I think that there are two pieces of the website in particular that I have expressed my concern about. Again, though, this relates to the doctrine. What I like is that there are conversations which parents are having with their loved ones, and the encouragement is to stay in the conversation. Many times when young people or adults who are coming out, number one, they won't have the conversation. And it's much like Cliff said in the previous interviews, that if mom or dad accidentally says that, you know, we would hate it if you were gay, or you know, we don't like your friend who's gay, then that really impedes the young person or adult's likelihood to come out. And so that is isolating. And, you know, a person who's isolating usually lives a double life, and that's a great drain on their mental health and their self-esteem. And when we have that, we usually make choices that are not in support of our well-being.
In a press release, I mean, you said saving lives may be the greatest gift of this new resource for LDS members. Expand on that,
yes.
Valerie.
And I think that that's where, you know, our community has gotten concerned about our perception, the Pride Center's perception of this new website, because our work, in large part, is to save lives and to help keep families together while we educate families about these things that will happen with their youth and the ways in which they could deal with it and the resources that they could get to approach it in a different way other than rejection. And so from that frame, we absolutely believe that this will save lives. On the flip side, there is still the viewpoint from a child within the church that they are asked to be someone who they are not. And, you know, that part is that not acting on who they are or probably, I mean, it's going to range across the world, actually, you know, how much a parent will allow their child to express, you know, their happiness as a gay or transgender child. And so a child still has the feeling that their life, in order to be accepted by their church or their parents, must be led celibately. And so that's a real concern that I have. I know there are Mormon parents out there who have dealt nicely with this, that, you know, they've opened this relationship with their child, and their child has been able to be who they are in all ways, shape, and form, and they're being accepted by their families. So that's the best case scenario. The other challenge that we have is really the doctrinal one that says, you know, if you sin in this lifetime, then, you know, you are subject not to be united with your family in the next. And that's a very hopeless kind of conversation. And, you know, I would hope that, you know, there would be no way that I would be separated from my family ever. And so our challenges are in that area.
Senator-elect DeBacchus, what difference do you think this online site, this Mormons and Gays website, is going to make in the local conversation about gay rights, both within the community and in the broader Utah community, and maybe in your work on the Hill?
You know, a year or so ago, I went out to Ogden and attended the memorial service for a Weber State, Weber High School student who killed himself, and he was gay. And I spoke with some of his classmates before and listened to the incredible difficulty this young gay man, boy, really had. And it was last week that with Senator Robles, I went to the funeral of a 14-year-old boy from West Valley, who couldn't take it anymore, and who killed himself. He took a gun with one bullet in it. He didn't want to be a threat to anybody else. He just couldn't stand his life and the bullying and the lack of social acceptance and the myriad of problems that all teenage kids have, but suddenly get intensified in our community with bullying and this kind of rejection. This website for LDS kids and LDS families and hopefully bishops and LDS people all over Utah and all over the LDS world explains, I think, in a clarifying way that has never been explained before. And it gives permission, I think, for LDS people to do the right thing. That's a direction they always wanted to go in anyway. But here you have the Quorum of the 12 saying, look, we don't know why this happens. We don't know what the solution really is. But we do know this, that we need to love and embrace and understand, and that LGBT people are as should be accepted under the same circumstances as everybody else, that will have a dramatic and positive effect in our community and in our state. And for that, I salute. The fact that it doesn't go far enough in the eyes of some on a doctrinal level, you know what? Church doctrines are not my bailiwick. But as far as embrace and understanding and compassion and dignity, giving dignity to a group of people, this is certainly a great step in that direction.
State Senator-elect Jim DeBacchus, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Valerie Larrabee with the Utah Pride Center. Valerie, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our thanks to Jesse Ellis, our technical director, and Ryan Cron, who composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, planning for the future of downtown Salt Lake City. Join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.
The mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee, told us why her city is on the economic upswing, one of only three fully out of the recession, according to the Brookings Institution. Now it's on to Dallas and Pittsburgh. We're looking for the secrets to a solid recovery. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. This afternoon at 12 on KCPW.